I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's January 30th, and we have a lot to talk about. I wanted to start this new year by reviewing some of what I consider the basics of living with MS. Not so much the basics about MS treatment or rehabilitation, but the basics of everyday life. Last week, we talked with MS navigator Carla Turchek about how to maximize your health insurance benefits and minimize those insurance-related surprises. This week, we're going to meet another MS navigator as Christina Forster joins me to shed some light on employment rights when you're living with MS. Since I've had the good fortune to have MS navigators join me on the podcast for the past 2 weeks, I want to take this opportunity to remind you about this extraordinary no-cost support service that the National MS Society provides. MS navigators provide one-on-one individual problem-solving and support for people affected by MS, no matter what kind of problem you may be facing. And their ability to take on difficult and complex situations, find resources, identify solutions, and get those problems turned around, I think is nothing short of amazing. Sometimes living with MS can get complicated, but before you let a problem or a challenging situation overwhelm you, I hope you'll reach out to an MS navigator. You can reach MS navigators by phone at 1-800-344-4867. By email at contactusnmss@nmss.org, or on the MS Society's website by chat. And you'll find all of that contact information in today's show notes. Which brings me to a bit of housekeeping that I'd like to take care of. If you've listened to even a couple of episodes of Real Talk MS, you've heard me remind you that you can find links to studies or other information in the show notes. And some of you have told me you're not sure about what these show notes are or where they can be found. So let's take a minute to review everything you need to know about the show notes for Real Talk MS. The best podcasts include show notes. That's why I produce show notes for every episode of Real Talk MS. In these notes, you'll find generic information like all the ways you can contact me, how to join our private Facebook group, but each week's show notes also make it easy to navigate that week's podcast episode. They give you a quick summary of what the episode is about and even provide timestamps for each segment in the episode so you can get to the specific topics or information that you might be most interested in. But maybe the most useful information in the show notes are the links. When I talk about the results of a clinical trial or a research study on the podcast, I always include a link to the published paper about those study results, and I do that for two reasons. First, it's important to me that you know the information I share on the podcast is reliable. Letting you review the published source is the easiest way for me to do that. And I also appreciate that some of you want to drill down into the details of a particular study. I want to make that easy for you, and providing a link to that source material puts all those details one click away. You should know that not every podcast app lets you see show notes, but you can always find the show notes to every episode of Real Talk MS at realtalkms.com. You'll find the show notes to the current episode right on our homepage. And if you click on past episodes at the top of the page, you'll see a listing of every one of our 300 plus episodes. Clicking on any of those episode listings will take you to that episode's show notes, and you'll even see a player that will let you listen to that episode. So now when you hear me say you'll find a link in today's show notes, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about and where to find them. And speaking of knowing exactly what I'm talking about, if you're living with MS and you're employed, you absolutely have to know what you're talking about when it comes to your rights in the workplace. How and to whom should you disclose your MS at your job and your right to reasonable accommodation? How you should handle taking time off for multiple medical appointments and what should be the best approach to taking a day or two off after receiving your disease-modifying therapy infusion if it leaves you feeling less than 100%. Christina Forster is here to walk us through all of this and more. But before we get to my conversation with Christina, there are a few other things that you should know about. Just a few weeks ago, in Real Talk MS episode number 332, I shared the results of a study involving 189 people with MS that found no association between gluten consumption and MS disease activity. And if you happen to miss that, you can visit realtalkms.com/332 and get caught up on the details of that study. Today, I want to share the results of a small study involving 16 people with MS, and the results of that study show that a diet low in wheat may reduce inflammation and improve quality of life among people living with MS. This study actually built upon the results of a previous study from the same research team, which showed that non-gluten proteins found in wheat, called amylase trypsin inhibitors, or ATI, exacerbated disease severity in the mouse model of MS. These proteins also increased the volume of inflammatory immune cells in the central nervous system. Now, interestingly, in this same study, gluten itself did not have an impact on disease severity in the mouse model of MS. So, 16 people with relapsing remitting MS were recruited for the pilot study that followed that earlier work. The study participants all had stable disease without relapses in the prior 3 months, and all of the study participants were on a disease-modifying therapy. The study participants were asked to continue their standard diet that included wheat for 3 months, and then they were asked to switch to a mostly wheat-free diet for another 3 months. The data indicate that this resulted in an 88% reduction in wheat consumption. The outcome of this study is interesting. First, there wasn't any change in the level of inflammatory T cells circulating in the bloodstream. However, there was a decrease in certain subsets of T cells. Other types of immune cells also showed changes under the wheat-reduced diet. And the study participants experienced significant improvements in pain-related quality of life, while other quality of life categories and overall disability remained unchanged. The research team concluded that a wheat-free diet can reduce the severity of MS and other inflammatory diseases. As a next step, the scientists are planning studies combining a wheat-free diet with other drug therapies. The research team was also quick to point out that this was a small study, and they emphasized the need for a larger-scale clinical trial, which should include participants with more severe MS and have a longer follow-up time. Now, if you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. Over the past year, you've heard me talk about the proposal by the International Advisory Committee on Clinical Trials in Multiple Sclerosis to adopt a new framework that redefines how we talk about MS, how we research MS, how we diagnose MS, and how we treat MS. This proposed framework describes MS in terms of the biological mechanisms that are taking place in an individual's central nervous system, instead of by the clinical symptoms that individual may be experiencing. It leverages what scientists have learned about MS over the almost 30 years since the very familiar disease course descriptors, relapsing remitting, secondary progressive, and primary progressive, have been in use. In other words, technology and scientific discovery now allow us to be much more precise in describing MS, which means emerging treatments can also be more precise. Well, scientific discovery and medical advancement are by no means limited to researching and treating multiple sclerosis. In a newly published paper, a team of Parkinson's disease experts has called for Parkinson's disease to be redefined on the basis of biology rather than the clinical features of the disease, proposing a staging system based on biomarkers and the level of functional impairment someone living with Parkinson's disease is experiencing. So, why am I bringing up Parkinson's disease on a podcast about MS? It's because I've heard from some of you who have shared your concerns about the proposed framework for defining MS. And the question or comment seems to be, the current system is working well, so why change it? So I wanted to share this news from the Parkinson's disease community to demonstrate that this is what scientific advancement looks like, and it's happening all around us. You do the most with the tools at hand, and when technology allows you to develop better tools, you leverage those new tools to improve things. Technology is accelerating the rate of scientific discovery as we've never seen it happen before, allowing scientists to learn more and then to leverage that learning to make things better than they were. MS isn't excluded from this process of discovery. This proposed framework for describing MS will require collaboration with healthcare providers, people living with MS, the research community, regulatory agencies like the FDA and the European Medicines Agency, pharmaceutical companies, private insurance companies. This is a heavy lift, but transformational change always is. We'll keep talking about it, and I'll keep doing my best to make sure that all of your questions get answered. The John Cunningham virus, named after the doctor who discovered it in 1971 and often referred to as the JC virus, is a common virus that's carried by most adults. And for most adults, it's harmless. But in some people who are on immunosuppressive therapies, this virus is awakened and it begins attacking the cells that produce myelin, triggering a rare but serious disease called progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy, or PML. 30 to 50% of the people who contract PML die within the first few months following their diagnosis. And a few MS disease-modifying therapies are among the immunosuppressive therapies that can trigger PML. The DMT most often associated with developing PML is Tysabri, but other treatments, including Tecfidera, Gilenya, Kesimpta, and Ocrevus can also increase the risk of developing PML. Now, it should be obvious that the overwhelming majority of people who take Tysabri, Tecfidera, Gilenya, Kesimpta, and Ocrevus do not develop PML. So the question for researchers is, why do some people with a weakened immune system develop this often fatal disease? And researchers have answered that question, pointing to our DNA. In a study published in 2022, researchers identified rare variations in four specific genes that were significantly associated with an increased risk of PML in people who were on these therapies or for other reasons had compromised immune systems. All four of these genes are known to be involved in regulating the immune response. Now, the good news is that scientists have developed a genetic test that will identify those four specific genes, which allows an individual to know whether they're at higher risk of developing PML before beginning treatment with any immunosuppressive therapy. The even better news here is that, for now, that genetic test is available at no cost by visiting PMLRiskTest.org. Now, if you'd like to learn more about this research, or if you're interested in finding out more about the no-cost genetic test, you'll find links in today's show notes. When we're talking about MS research, we often talk about studies involving the mouse model of MS. My question today is, what about the zebrafish? Did you know that zebrafish have myelin that's similar to the myelin found in humans and other mammals? And did you know that young zebrafish are transparent, which allows scientists to observe things in live fish in real time? And the reason we're talking about zebrafish today is that using powerful imaging, pharmacology, and genetic tools, Researchers at Oregon Health and Science University have identified specific proteins and signals related to hotspots that are involved in the communication between nerves and cells that make myelin, and they've discovered that the cell communication in these hotspots predicts when and where myelin will form in zebrafish. Our brain has the ability to repair damaged myelin, but over time, people with MS lose that ability. Learning more about how the communication in these hotspots affects myelin formation can identify potential therapeutic targets for promoting myelin repair and restoring lost function to people living with MS. The research team is continuing their work in studying this mechanism in myelin formation, and if you'd like to review their work in this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. The Spanish Society of Neurology has updated its guidelines for treating MS, and the new guidelines emphasize the importance of early diagnosis and prompt, aggressive treatment. This is the fourth iteration of the guidelines for MS treatment that have been published by the Spanish Society of Neurology's Demyelinating Diseases Study Group. The guidelines were originally published in 2010 and then updated in 2013 and again in 2017. This update of the guidelines reflects a growing acceptance of an evolving MS treatment strategy. For the longest time, someone newly diagnosed with MS would be prescribed a so-called first-line disease-modifying therapy that offered lower efficacy but also less risk of side effects. And patients would stay on that DMT until an increase in disease activity showed that it was no longer working. Then they could escalate to stronger, so-called second-line treatments. But study results published over the past few years have shown that people with MS who start on one of the high-efficacy disease-modifying therapies, these are therapies which may also carry a higher risk of side effects, well, they tend to have less disability progression over time compared with people who start on a lower-efficacy DMT. That emerging treatment strategy is implicit in these new guidelines. The new guidelines suggest that the classic first-line and second-line terminology should be abandoned and instead recommends that typical second-line treatments may be given as initial therapy. This recommendation is more strongly made in consideration of those individuals who are at risk of experiencing higher levels of disease activity, including men, individuals with a history of smoking, individuals who may already have other health conditions, and individuals experiencing multiple relapses in the first year after MS onset, or have a lot of disease activity that's visible on MRI scans. Recent studies have also shown that individuals who experience an initial attack of an MS-like disease, referred to as clinically isolated syndrome, or CIS, are less likely to develop MS if they receive treatment with MS disease-modifying therapy, and the updated guidelines recommend starting this treatment as soon as possible. Finally, the new guidelines from the Spanish Society of Neurology address an MS treatment plan for women who are planning a pregnancy, recommending treating these women so their MS is stable without any new disease activity for at least 1 year before they try to get pregnant. And then MRI exams should be avoided during pregnancy to prevent damage to the fetus. Citing a lack of data, the guidelines recommend that decisions about continuing treatment during pregnancy, especially in unplanned pregnancies, should be made on a case-by-case basis. If you'd like to review the 2023 guidelines on MS treatment issued by the Spanish Society of Neurology, you'll find that link in today's show notes. Understanding these new MS treatment guidelines is going to allow neurologists in Spain to provide the very best care to their patients. And understanding the guidelines for managing your job when you're living with MS will allow you to perform your work to the best of your ability. Joining me in a moment to shed some light on your rights while you're at work is MS Navigator Christina Forster. With symptoms that range from very mild to quite severe, MS can affect a person's ability to work. That's why I'm happy to have Christina Forster returning to the podcast, this time to talk about your employment rights and protections, as well as options for people who are newly diagnosed with MS. Christina is a member of the National MS Society's MS Navigator team, so if you're a regular listener, you know that I'm already a fan. Christina is also a certified rehabilitation counselor, and she specializes in benefits and employment issues. Welcome back to the podcast, Christina.
Thank you so much for having me.
When someone is diagnosed with MS, they tend to get a lot of unsolicited advice from well-meaning family members and friends. But all that advice aside, when it comes to your job, how do you know when it's the right time to leave the workforce?
Yeah, that's a great question. You're right. We do hear often about loved ones encouraging a person with MS to leave the workplace because they see them struggling, but that might not be the only option or the best option. So, I think that a person really needs to consider all of the options that they have available to them, whether that's looking into accommodations, taking a little bit of time off of work with maybe private disability through their employer, talking to the healthcare providers to see what they think about their situation and if they believe that they are still able to continue working, or it could mean looking at exploring a different type of career.
Can someone actually be terminated from their job because they have MS?
Another great question. So simply for having MS, no, they cannot be let go. But there is a caveat. A person could be let go if their MS causes a direct threat to themselves or to others at their employment. And then also the person does need to be able to do their job. They have to be qualified to do their job, and whether that's with or without reasonable accommodations.
We'll get into those reasonable accommodations in just a moment. I'm curious, if you do decide to disclose your diagnosis to your employer, Is your employer required to keep that information confidential?
That really depends on who you decide to tell, because there's a couple of different people you could tell. If you talk to HR and you disclose your diagnosis, they are legally bound to keep that information confidential. However, if somebody decides to disclose to their supervisor isn't legally bound to keep that information private. Of course, you know, we hope that morally that they would do the right thing and keep that information private. And then when it comes to coworkers, there's no reason that they have to not share that information if they want to. So it depends, and people should really think about who they're telling.
You know, everyone living with any sort of disability should know about the Americans with Disabilities Act, or ADA. So can you review what someone's rights and protections are under the ADA?
Yeah, so under the ADA, it applies to certain employers with 15 or more employees, and the idea is to allow full participation for a person with a disability and to help prevent discrimination. And it applies to all parts of the employment process, and that could be the application process, hiring, firing, promotions, compensation, and other privileges of employment. And then under the ADA, it does ensure the right for a person to request reasonable accommodations if they have disclosed their disability to their employer. A person does need to be qualified to do their job, and they have to be able to perform the essential functions of the job with or without reasonable accommodations. So that's a quick explanation of it, but there are a lot of resources available that can provide additional information.
Well, I heard the term reasonable accommodation a couple of times. Tell us about reasonable accommodation and maybe share some examples of what that could look like.
Sure. A reasonable accommodation can be a modification to the way that a job is performed or to the building that the job is in. And there are lots of creative ways to accommodate individuals with MS. And some examples could be longer breaks, working from home, flexible work schedule, reduced hours, specialized equipment, assistive technology, an ergonomic workstation. I mean, the list really goes on and on. That's just a few examples of what reasonable accommodations could be. And we do also know, I like to point this out too, is that a lot of times the need and type of accommodation that a person needs could change over time as symptoms change or when a person experiences a relapse or an increase of symptoms.
How does someone go about making this kind of a request? Who should they be talking to?
So this goes back to one of the other questions, kind of who to tell, kind of thinking about who you want to request the accommodation for. HR needs to be involved at some point. Again, they're legally bound to keep this information confidential, but sometimes people do go to their direct supervisors because they have a good relationship with them and they feel that they will support them. But if they do go to their direct supervisor first, you know, they'll have to bring HR in at some point to help with the process as well.
Can an employer deny a request for a reasonable accommodation? And if they can, what should an employee do if that request has been denied?
An employer can deny a request for a reasonable accommodation. Well, one reason could be that they don't think that it is reasonable and they think it's an undue hardship. But for others, you know, if the accommodation is denied, there are a few things that people can do to explore the next steps. One would be trying to figure out what was the reason for the denial. Was it because there wasn't enough medical documentation? Was it because, you know, it was an undue hardship? And in these cases, that can be corrected by either, you know, providing additional documentation or suggesting other reasonable accommodation ideas. And if they think that their employer did not give them a valid reason or they simply didn't give a reason at all, then this person can appeal that decision. They can go up the chain of commands. They can file a grievance with the union if they have one, and they could fill out complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which is the place that enforces the ADA.
And going beyond just the ADA, what should someone living with MS do if they think their employment rights have been violated?
If they think that their employment rights have been violated, I mean, one thing is, again, to check to see if they have a union and they could have the union help with them. If there's an internal process for filing a grievance, they could do that. Because if they're able to kind of get this resolved internally, that is much better than having to go through the legal process. But they also can talk to an attorney, consult with an attorney, see what the attorney believes, if they think that the law has been violated or not, and kind of help determine what the next steps would be. And then there's that ability to file a complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission.
Now, I know MS navigators don't give legal advice, but an MS navigator can explain what your legal rights are, and you can make referrals. So how can someone reach an MS navigator to review their situation?
Yeah, sure. A person can reach an MS navigator by calling our 1-800 number, and that's 800-344-4867. And they can connect with an employment expert that way. They can also visit our website and connect via chat or email. And then that way, you know, they can get connected with somebody that specializes in employment, such as myself, and we can talk to them about their employment goals and concerns, and hopefully they're able then to make an informed decision about their employment situation.
You just mentioned someone can contact you and talk about their employment goals. That sort of suggests that someone can contact you before they actually are experiencing a problem, but want to proactively plan for the twists and turns that employment might take later. Is that a conversation you can have with someone as an MS navigator?
Yeah, absolutely. We can talk to individuals who, you know, maybe they're not experiencing difficulty at work right now, but they just want to understand what their options would be if they were to have problems later on. I mean, as we know, MS is unpredictable. Symptoms come and go, and these things can happen quickly. So it's really important to have those discussions about what a person's legal rights are, concerns around disclosure, concerns around accommodations. Sometimes we see people who don't do this proactively come to us kind of in a crisis, and they're not even aware of what their rights are. So it's best if we can have these conversations beforehand, so they're not scrambling to get that information while they're going through a stressful situation like that.
Well, Christina Forster, thank you for all you and the MS Navigator team do to improve the quality of life for people affected by MS. My listeners have heard me say this before. I believe the MS Navigator team, they set the gold standard for individualized, customized solutions to the kinds of problems that people affected by MS face every single day. Thanks for all of that, and thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me, John.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society, and you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/335. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or a text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes. And it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.